Hi, everybody. Welcome to another week of This Week in Blog. Bill Scherr is off this week, and I'm Con Carroll. I blog for the Heritage Foundation. I'm the lone official blogger over here. This week, filling in for Bill, we have Terrence Heath, who both blogs for Campaign for America's Future, and much longer before that, blogged at the Republic of Tea, the subtitle of which is Black, Gay, Father, Vegetarian, Buddhist, Liberal, which when I was covering blogs for National Journal was definitely one of my favorite subheads for a blog. So it's good to finally get to talk to you, Terrence.
Well, thank you. Thanks. I use that subhead so that people would know what they were getting.
It's very instructive. You know right where you're starting. And I like the little Buddha mascot there too.
Right.
Lots going on. I think with your subtitle, you would probably be a good person to talk to about what's been going on Proposition 8 out in California.
Yeah. It's been interesting. Let's just say an interesting couple of weeks since the election, and the word bittersweet has been
bandied about
a lot. Where we are right now with that is that there's a review that's happening before the California Supreme Court, and my understanding is the issue is that they're deciding whether or not the passage of Proposition 8, I guess.
It's technical. It's whether, and this is just for California Supreme Court law, mm-hmm. but it's whether Proposition 8 either amended or revised the Constitution.
Right.
And so apparently it all comes down to the difference between amended and revised, which if you look in a dictionary, there's not much difference, but there's case law in California.
And not being a constitutional law,
or even California constitutional law
expert, I can't say, which side carries, which argument carries more weight.
I also have never studied California constitutional.
But it boils down to that question, and whether it is whether it's I guess they define it by what it does. That's the best the best that I can make of it.
What have you been making of all the demonstrations out in California, both in San Francisco and
LA? I think that there was a lot of visceral anger and disappointment, and especially for families in California, the 18,000 families whose legal relationships have been invalidated, and their legal rights as families are in a state of flux are thrown into question.
Right, we don't even know if for the ones that already have entered into marriage under California law, what happens to those. We know that people can't issue more licenses, but we don't even know what happens to those people who got married in the
end. That's an open question as far as I know. But I think that there are a lot of reasons. Are a lot of explanations out there for what happened, both in terms of how well the opponents of Proposition 8 organized themselves versus how well the supporters of Proposition 8 were organized, who reached out to which communities and which communities weren't reached out to. And I think that there's a lot of, I don't want to say there's more than enough blame to go around, but there are a lot of things about this that should hopefully give people something to think about. And how can I put this, a way to move forward.
Let me read you a post from a conservative blogger here in D.C. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you've ever run into her. LaShawn Barber.
Yes, I think I've met her once. Yeah.
I have too. LaShawn writes, "It's common knowledge by now that 70% of black voters in California voted for Proposition 8, a measure that defines marriages between only a man and a woman. Almost three-quarters of black voters, although the vast majority voted for Barack Obama. But that's another topic for other posts. The tension between blacks and white homosexuals has provided much fodder for mainstream media, reporters, and bloggers. They're peeved at black liberals for voting against the interests of their fellow brother in arms. She then goes on to cite some news articles about white homosexuals protesting in front of Mormon temples.
Right.
Mm-hmm. And then she writes, why haven't white homosexuals protested in black neighborhoods in front of black churches?
Well, there are... where should I start?
Wherever you want to.
Well, first of all, the 70% of black voters voting for Proposition 8 mm-hmm. is based on an exit poll. Mm-hmm. And so it doesn't address how many African-American voters in California actually voted for Proposition 8. It addresses how many of the African-American voters who answered, who participated in the exit poll supported Proposition 8. So that's the first thing, is that I don't think we can clearly say 70% of black voters in California voted for Proposition 8. I think...
Would you acknowledge it's probably northward of 60-65%?
You know, I won't.
Your honest feeling about what that percentage is?
I wouldn't be surprised if, and there's no way of knowing it, I wouldn't be surprised if a large percentage, perhaps a majority of African American voters in California who voted in this election did support Proposition 8, just based on my own experience and the cultural and historical factors of homosexuality and
right.
how it is or isn't dealt with in African American communities.
So, growing up in California myself, I met a lot more African Americans than I did Mormons. So I guess I would challenge whether or not it's more useful to, you know, as you said, bring up and make this more of an issue in the black community as opposed to protesting in front of Mormon temples.
I think that that's kind of the direction that things are moving in. There's been a lot of discussion about it, and the reality is, and I have, as someone who has written a lot and blogged a lot about the homophobia that does exist in many or too many African American communities, I think that there's kind of an understanding that, you know, even if every single African American in California were registered to vote and voted in the election and voted against Proposition 8, African Americans in California don't make up enough of a percentage to have caused it to pass or fail by themselves. The focus that you're seeing now on, you know, people protesting outside of Mormon churches, and not just outside of Mormon churches, there was a protest outside of Saddleback Church that is really just kind of people expressing their frustration and how they feel about the amount of money and work that was put into basically taking equal protections away from these families.
So, I mean, I guess what I'm hearing is that you really feel as though the Mormon Church really is more responsible for the passage of Prop 8
I think that
whatever number of African Americans did or did not vote for it.
I think that like I said, there's enough responsibility to go around. There have been a lot of questions asked and discussions by LGBT bloggers, African American and non-African American, about what the No on 8 campaign did or didn't do. Mm-hmm. That it should have in terms of reaching out to African American communities. I wrote a post on my blog called Marriage Matters to Us because I read a post by Jasmine Kanick about basically saying that, well, marriage just isn't an important issue for black gays and lesbians.
No, I'm sorry, you're not filling on who Jasmine is.
Jasmine Kanick is a journalist and activist in California.
Okay.
She's a blogger. She is a former board member of the National Black Justice Coalition, which is
okay.
a national black gay and lesbian organization. And when I read her piece, I wanted to counter that with the information that I have always known or had about the African-American gay and lesbian couples in California, in Maryland, and in New Jersey that were party to or were plaintiffs in these marriage lawsuits. And
but what exactly was her point that, you know, there wasn't a lot to be gained by?
Well, her point was that there were more important issues to focus on. There were economic issues to focus on, HIV and AIDS issues, a host of other issues that are indeed important issues. And my point was that this is an important issue too. I don't. I guess I'm not prioritizing it in the same way. I'm not saying that it's more important than all of the other issues, because I work on a lot of those issues myself, both personally and professionally. But as a gay man, as a husband and a father, two small children, it has to be an important issue to me. Being able to protect my family as much as possible is just not something that I can make a secondary issue for me. And I think that's true of a lot of people. And the families that I wrote about in my post all experienced direct economic impacts from inequality. Inequality, in just in terms of.
What about you in Maryland? There, I mean, I just heard you say you're a husband, and
yes,
I could be wrong, but I don't believe that Maryland recognizes.
No, Maryland doesn't. But my husband.
So what is the impact on you?
Well, the impact on me right now is that. Like another couple in Maryland, when we decided to have a family, we spent I don't know how many thousands of dollars hiring a lawyer and getting legal documents from, you know, drawing up wills, advance directives, medical powers of attorney that give us about maybe three or so protections of the 1,400 plus. That come with a marriage license that, in my county of Maryland, costs $55, and I think a 3-day waiting period. My point was that that's about 5 cents per benefit or protection, as opposed to paying, you know, one couple paid $6,000 for legal documents that might not even be recognized.
Well, you know, as I'm not an expert in family law, but some of those 1,400 protections are worth more than others.
Yeah, that's true. That's true. But I mean, and you know, we could go through it and itemize them out. But there are a lot of them that people take for granted. On the issue of inheritance, we have wills, mm-hmm. so we have to have wills because we don't have automatic inheritance rights. But you know, if my husband and the husband of the woman that lives across the street from us were on the same plane and it crashed, she wouldn't pay taxes on what her husband left to her in his will, but I would on what my husband would leave to me in his.
It's great to hear you guys concerned about death taxes.
And we both, you know, are raising two children. But that goes to Social Security. It goes to, you know, death benefits from employers. It goes to even if you're renting, you know, an apartment together, there are some protections that if you are married and your spouse passes away, that you can't immediately or automatically be evicted. You know, the little things like that happen every day with our families, and there are things that you can't put a price on, as well. We have a friend who, he and his husband, we rented their wedding. We celebrated the adoption of their son with them, and they were a black gay couple. And 2 years ago, his husband collapsed at work, and he did what anybody would do when you get a call that your spouse has collapsed and has been rushed to the hospital. You drop everything and you go. You make sure your child is safe and that you can put them in a safe place while you go to see what's wrong. And he arrived at the hospital and was told, well, without legal proof of your relationship, we can't give you any information and you can't see him. And he drives home not knowing what's wrong or if his husband's going to be alive or dead, gets the legal documents and comes back to the hospital. And he does see his husband, who passes away a couple days later of a brain aneurysm. I told that story to my married heterosexual neighbor down the street when they came over for dinner. And she told me a story about her husband being rushed to the hospital. And when she arrived at the hospital, she said three words: I'm his wife. And they said three words to her: right this way.
Yeah, and she didn't even have to show any proof that she was
exactly. And you don't have to show, I mean, nobody that I've ever known has to show, you know, their marriage license in a situation like that. But because of that story, you know, my family, we do not travel without copies of all of our legal documents. I have copies in my desk at work, and my husband has copies in his desk at work. Because
let me ask you one more question.
Mm-hmm.
This kind of goes back to something Barack Obama talked about in the campaign trail. Actually, not something he talked about, but an interview that came out from NPR. And it's the one where he was talking about redistribution of wealth through the courts. And David Bernstein at the Bullock Conspiracy wrote about Obama's view on the redistribution of wealth and what it said about his view of the civil rights movement. This is Bernstein. Before getting to the controversy, the whole interview is worth listening to for another reason. Obama gives a very impressive performance as a constitutional scholar. Even though he was holding down other jobs while teaching at Chicago, he clearly had a thought about constitutional history and how social change is not brought about through the courts. Among other things, I was impressed that rather than accept the cartoonish view that often prevails about the practical significance of Brown versus Board of Education, he knew that very few black students in the South were attending integrated schools as late as the early 1960s, almost a decade after Brown, and that it was only the threat of a cutoff of federal funds that really got the desegregation moving. On the issue of whether Obama endorses redistribution of wealth through the courts, it certainly sounds to me like he thinks Rodriguez, a case holding 5-4 that unequal funding for public schools does not violate the Equal Protection Clause, was wrongly decided, and that state courts that have mandated equal funding for public schools are correct. But he also seems to think there was a huge error for activists to try to achieve more general redistribution through the Due Process Clause of the 14th Amendment. In the waning days of the Warren Court, there's a movement to try to constitutionalize a right to a minimum income. Co-interviewee Dennis Hutchinson even suggests that in pre-interview conversation, Obama agreed with him that Goldberg versus Kelly establishing a procedural protections for welfare recipients was wrongly decided, or at least promised much more than it could possibly achieve. Based on this interview, it seems likely to me that Obama opposes constitutionalizing the redistributive agenda because he's an originalist or otherwise endorses the Constitution as a charter of negative liberties, though he explicitly recognizes that this is how the Constitution has been interpreted since the founding. Rather, he seems to think that focusing on litigation distracts liberal activists from necessary political organizing and that any radical victories they might manage to win from the courts would be unstable because those decisions wouldn't have public backing. And I guess it's that last thought that kind of brings me back to what we've been seeing in California, is that you know, much like the civil rights movement, and I'm sure you would argue that the fight for same-sex marriage is an extension of the civil rights movement, is that a lot of it has gone through the courts. And you know what Obama was saying in this interview essentially was that there's only so much social change that can be brought about by courts. Without some type of backlash or that undermines the movement, and that other types of political action, reaching out, trying to affect laws through the ballot box, would be better goals for progressive goals, in this case the civil rights movement. So I just wanted your thoughts on that distinction and whether or not you think, you know, keeping litigating this Prop 8 issue really is helping or hurting the same-sex marriage.
I think that that it's not an either-or situation. I think that, first of all, that the courts are a legitimate means of achieving justice. One of the beauties of our system is that it acknowledges that might does not make right. Might, in terms of numbers, in this case, that the majority can be wrong, and it gives a minority an avenue to seek justice that that other that organizations like, for example, the NAACP, which is part of one of the civil rights groups that are appealing appealing to the Supreme Court on the passage of Proposition 8, their concern is that it sets a precedent that minority rights can be decided by little more than a simple majority vote.
Let me hold on right there, because I mean, you were talking before about how you had some criticisms of the Prop 8 campaign,
mm-hmm.
And I assume you believe that the strategy to get same-sex marriage created in California, the legal strategy to do that was right. And I guess my question would be, do you think the resources and time devoted to the legal strategy might have been better used all along in doing that community outreach that you talked about earlier that was the problem,
mm-hmm.
with the No on Proposition 8 campaign?
I don't think that it's an either-or. I think that there could have been things done differently, probably by the No on 8 campaign, in terms of how they portrayed their message and the communities that they reached out to and how they reached out to them. My point is that in any movement for social change, you need both. And one route is a more immediate one than another, and that is through the courts. And the reason that I think that it's a legitimate route is because I want to preserve the principle that that might does not make right, and that justice shouldn't always have to wait for enough people to finally decide, okay, that might does not make right, and also that it is a route that people have to justice so that they are not basically asked, and it's the old debate between slow and immediate social change. On one end of that spectrum, there's a lot more social tension. But on the other end, you have people who are basically asked to continue to endure injustice without remedy. And that, you know, isn't acceptable either. There, part of the reason that I think you see so much passion behind this is that there are people like me who have made commitments and who have started families. And I have to tell you, it changes so much about your priorities and your outlook on the world, and there's nothing more important to me than my family, and I will do whatever I can to protect my family as much as possible. And so you need both ends of that. You need the push and the pull. The other kind of activism that you're talking about happens on my street with all of the other families around us, and all of the kids that are going to school with you know, my kids, with my 6-year-old son, who have always known our family as a family, and have always seen it as a family, and take their cue from their parents, who we're fortunate enough to live in a community where our family is completely accepted as a part of the community. So that kind of thing, I think, moves people along. And there are always, in those situations, people who have never dealt with, you know, who have never even seen a same-sex family with children. And, you know, live across the street from us for a while, and you see that, you know, we go to work, we put our children on the school bus and hop on the bus and go to work and come home and have dinner and...
take your kids to soccer games,
etc. Yeah, and literally take the kids to the soccer games, etc. And that's one area, that's one way that change is happening. And that's constant. That's always happening. And it's happening to a greater degree probably now than it has in a long time. And it doesn't mean that there's not more work to be done.